Hello, and welcome to the Painter Bread Quarterly Slush Pile. So glad that you're joining us today. We're doing this podcast in order to be transparent about our Democratic editorial policy. So what we do is select work right from the slush pile and ask the authors for permission to read their work on air and then discuss it and have our editorial meeting right here on this podcast. In front of you, as it were. So the we includes me. I am Kathleen Volk Miller. Hello, hello, hello. And I'm going to bounce it right over to the UAE and say hello, Marion Wren.
Oh, I'm in the UAE. This is Marion Wren, and it's a Friday here. And so the weekend is upon us, and I'm 9 hours ahead of everybody else on this call, I think, including Dagny in Canada, which means it, I'm here to greet you from the weekend. So I'm going to bounce it over to Canada.
Thanks, Marion. Yeah, it's Friday night there. I mean, yeah, that's a nice welcome to the weekend. It's a little early to start, I don't know, drinking here, but yeah. I'm
It's
definitely.
11 a.m. on Friday. It's
Yeah,
Friday. Whatever.
exactly.
Whatever.
That reminds me of having to fend off my mother-in-law at a birthday party for a child where she was trying to have me to have a glass of wine at 11 a.m. It was I really had to say no, I'm good, thanks. So with
It's
that
a
all,
party.
yeah, exactly. I'll roll it down to Jason with that.
Yes, day drinking. That's what drag brunch is for. Not children's birthday parties, drag brunch. And bottomless mimosas. What have I been doing with my time? I guess we all know now. Yes, I'm
Drag
Jason Schneiderman. I am in beautiful New York City, and it is 11 in the morning, and I am still drinking coffee, as I will all day long because I do love coffee. And
brunch. So good. So good.
right. And Samantha, where are you?
Hi everyone, I'm Samantha Neugebauer and I am in DC, where I am also still drinking coffee and probably will do that for most of the day as well. and I am going to pass it back to Philadelphia to Talia.
Hi, I'm Talia. I'm here in West Philly. I unfortunately don't drink coffee, but I'm a smoothie drinker actually in the morning, so
Oh, but a coffee smoothie.
No. What kind of smoothie, Talia? What kind of smoothie?
Coffee smoothie.
this morning I actually had a strawberry banana mango smoothie.
Nice.
Ooh,
I hear they're good
Nice.
with whiskey.
Spicy.
You go to one of
Probably
Drexel's
later
food
in the night.
trucks? You go to one of Drexel's food trucks for that smoothie?
It depends on if they're open today. It wasn't open, so I ended up just going to Wawa.
Oh,
Wawa.
okay.
Yeah.
Wawa. Wawa.
Wawa.
Celia, shall you introduce our new team member?
Yes, of course. So I'm actually graduating in the next few weeks.
Oh, woohoo! Bittersweet, bittersweet.
Woo!
It is sad to go, but I will be handing off slush pile to a great and amazing coworker, Heath Bailey.
Hi, Heath.
Woohoo!
Welcome, Heath.
Hi, guys. How's it going? I'm Heath. I don't drink coffee either. I actually have a nice bottle of ginger lemon tea.
Oh,
Ooh.
wow. Way to
I
go,
do
Heath.
approve
What's
of the
this
ginger lemon tea.
generation? No debauchery anywhere you look. Not a
Approve
one.
this generation. That's what I want to know.
Do you ever do the thing where you actually like cut up the ginger root and the lemon and just put it in the saucepan and like boil it and
So I don't actually boil it, but that is basically just how I make my tea. I cut up the ginger and then I just put hot water and the lemon in
Oh,
and some
real
sugar.
deal. So
Good.
wow.
Great way to go, Heath.
Sometimes
Highly
my
recommend. And goes great with coffee.
husband ginger. Sometimes my husband leaves like pieces of ginger root in the house to scare me because I think it looks like, bones or something sometimes.
That's
Like
awesome.
in the cupboard. I'm like,
Oh my God.
oh.
Damon, that's hysterical, right? That is, they do look like bony witch hands, right? Or like a witch foot, right?
Which foot?
Speaking of breakfast drinks, right before I left England, Costa started doing warm milkshakes. And I was like, oh, a warm milkshake. It was the most disgusting thing I have ever
Oh,
put in my mouth.
no.
I
Wow.
you know me and sweet things. I could I
No.
barely made a dent in it. I was like, I tried like three or four times. I was like, oh, there's a reason ice cream is not hot. This is
Someone not tasted it.
I have seen
Yeah.
this man Hoover packages of Peeps. So he could not do
Yes. No,
the milkshake.
in college, my friends would go to the like the weird convenience store where you could use
Yeah.
your meal plan to buy
Yeah.
strange like reject candy that had somehow like after not selling in Sweden had ended up in college primarily. And I have eaten like buckets of cotton candy. I have eaten like giant snakes of like what do you call that? The pixie dust.
You should be in a sugar coma, clearly.
On a dare, I once ate a frozen candy that we found in the street, and this was worse.
All right.
Wow,
This was worse.
that's bizarre. Yeah, warm ice
Yeah.
cream.
No, at my
Yeah.
wedding, my friend, my because my friend always tells the story about the candy, the chocolate from the street, as though he didn't eat it as well. That he tells it as though I was the only one who ate it, and it's just not true. But he told the story at my wedding, and my mother shouted out, "Yes, Jason will put anything in his mouth when he was a child." And it's like, "Mom, what are you doing? This is my wedding." And she said, when he would drop a lollipop on the carpet, I would have to grab it from him because he would try to put it back in his mouth, and I'd have to rinse it off first, and he wouldn't even notice. And I was like, I.
Okay, so but to bring
And
it back to Costa, were they going
it was
for like an
disgusting.
affogato kind of thing and they just totally messed it up?
No, it was a milkshake that had been heated up, and it was horrible. I thought it'd be fine because ice cream, right? I mean, when you make ice cream, you start with custard, which is like a warm, right? A warm custard. Like custard starts warm. I mean, Hollandaise sauce and crème anglaise and all these
Absolutely.
things are the same. They're the same, right? They're the same ingredients, in different proportions. And so I thought, oh, all right, it'll be like a warm. No.
No.
Well, and I like
No.
that
Did not.
it
It
it's
was
making you sort of like a
disgusting.
life coach, right? You're sort of like, don't eat stuff off the ground, don't eat like warm milkshakes, right? And don't let your mother tell stories about your, wild propensity to eat whatever you're willing to put in your mouth at your wedding. It's good advice.
Yeah,
It's good advice.
it's good advice.
Indeed.
We should get to the poem.
We should. Let's talk about the poem. Let's put something else in our mouths.
Absolutely.
All right. So I think we're ready. And we're going to look at Kristen Hill's poem called Are We Still Good? And so I don't know, KVM, do you have a person you'd like to read Kristen Hill's poem?
Did you guys see that I was raptured? Or am I going to
Yeah.
be like that kid who leaves the
No.
party and nobody notices that I left?
No, we totally noticed you were raptured and you tried to cover it, but way to go, James Bond.
I didn't know if you let the slushies know. The
No,
very
we didn't.
special. This is a very special episode.
We didn't. You Thankfully, it want
was
to tell it?
free.
Yes, let's
Not
tell
only
the
are we educating them about Jason's sweet tooth, what not to drink, how to make ginger tea, we also are going to give you a surprise sneak preview to our next episode after we discuss Kristen Hill's poem. So
Awesome.
hang tight because we only have one poem today, but then we have a preview, a sneak peek, as it were.
I'm so glad you're back from being raptured. I don't think we could have handled that
Definitely
without
not.
you. So who would like to read Kristen Hill's Are We Still Good?
I volunteer Dagny.
All right. Yep, poor Dagny.
I will do my best. I will do my best. Are we still good? According to officials, the animal does not appear to be seriously injured. Someone adds in the comments that obviously it was just a joke. Calm down, liberals. Highlight the part in the article where the man's name was scraped onto algae growing on its skin. From what they could see, nothing was truly threatened. The sea cow was probably too dumb and fat to feel anything. I think of all the ways cruelty begins as a joke until it chooses to finish what it started. A friend I'd known for years didn't stop when I asked and asked again. I thought maybe he didn't hear me. Later, he told our mutual friend that things just got out of hand. I thought she knew I was just playing. I remember when I was sure he heard me. I recognized it was my fear that made him smile so loud. Still, I attempt to explain the surprise. At least I didn't die there, I tell myself. Even here, I wrote that as the first line of this poem and buried it. Anyways, he had work in the morning, offered to drive me home. I didn't have to walk back to my dorm in the snow. I laughed at everything he said on the way and tried not to let him see my handshake when I took the gum he offered me. He asked, "Are we still good?" I chewed my tongue, relieved that I could do something else with my mouth until he parked, unlocked the door to let me out. I thanked him. I was so scared that I didn't run.
Great reading, Bagney. What a great reading.
Well, wow, what a poem. What a poem. Oh.
Right?
There's a lot going in there, and I'm sorry, I'm going to say right up front, I think it's really deftly handled, because there are many points where you could get quite confused. At least I could. I'm going to admit that.
You know what? Since you said that word, do you mind if I start with my confusion?
Yeah.
I am confused at the line, "At least I didn't die there," I tell myself. I don't know what she's referring to, what the poet's referring to there. I think her friend was mean to a manatee, right?
Yeah.
And she asked him to stop and he didn't, and then it went viral and all that crap. But
I read it really differently.
Yeah, I didn't assume that the friend had anything to do with the manatee.
I thought she was like, go ahead, Sam.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought it was nonlinear, right? So she's telling the end of the story in the second half of the poem.
She's looking at a Facebook post or whatever post where people are kind of talking about this animal that's in terrible condition, and it's going back and forth between, you know, people who are horrified and people who are making fun of it. And then that brings her to think about someone who did something terrible to her, and we never actually find out what it is. Like, that kind of stays in aporia at the center of the poem. And so, but she's thinking about how joking is being used to mask cruelty, and then we get back to the aftermath of that event. And "At least I didn't die there" is kind of like the fulcrum of the poem, because that kind of tells us how dire the situation was, that this thing where he's like, "Oh, I was joking, we're still good, right?" Like, she's like, "I thought I was gonna die."
And Kathy, it is a great question, because for me, the overriding question that I have about this poem, I mean, I know how I feel about it and what I think about it, but for readers in general, is, do we need to know, right, what this friend said to the speaker of this poem that made them think, "At least I didn't die there," right? For me, I'm not struggling with that. I don't feel like I need to know. And arguably the whole, you know, Trump being inscribed on a manatee kind of gives us a feeling for the kind of things that it might have entailed. But I don't know. That's the big question this throws up.
I don't know, Dagny. It's like, it was really explicit without naming it, right? The friend I'd known for years didn't stop when I asked and asked again.
Right.
I thought he would hear me, right? And that's not about the manatee. It's about stage
rape.
Right.
So it could be a rape, right? It could be a rape. But I still didn't get, even with that read, I didn't understand. I didn't die there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see anything that in that implied anything got that out of hand, that she would think she was gonna die.
Right.
With
Well, I
that's
mean,
what
I guess
implies it.
unless sort of like that semantic field, like I was so scared that I didn't run, right? That like whatever it was that happened, she did feel that afraid, and the fear stays with her, right? Even though it's perceived as from the friend's side as like, she's overreacting. I thought she knew. I was joking. I was playing around, right? Yeah. I
Yeah.
chewed my tongue, relieved that I could do something else with my mouth until he parked, unlocked the door to let me out. I thanked him. Right? Like, wow.
I know
Wow.
the control implied
Yeah.
in that is
Yeah.
so
Yeah.
powerful. I mean, for me, I really do prefer not knowing what
Yeah.
happened because we're able to focus on those moments. You know, I was sure he heard me. I recognized it was my fear that made him smile so loud. I love that expression. I can see that. And the menace kind of implied in that.
And I think that by not saying it, it takes us out of any kind of, you know, adjudicating role that, you know, if we know what happened, then we sort of end up in this position of the friend, right, who heard secondhand and now has to be like, oh, am I still friends with this person? Am I still friends with that person? And, you know, kind of has
Right.
to do all this adjudication and sort of like, oh, okay, so I need your story and I need your story. And then we have to like, you know, and so I think that by not saying it, it takes us out of the role of, you know, do we think that it crossed a line? How far did it go? And just puts us in that position of this was terrifying, right? The person, it takes us out of any sort of adjudication and just puts us into that emotional state of terror without having. And so I think it's actually like a really smart withholding. Like I think that actually by leaving that absence at the center of the poem, it actually gives us a kind of empathy that we would lose if we actually had a blow by blow of what it
Right.
was. I mean, not that you can't tell a blow by blow of what it was, but in this particular case, I think actually is a very, very smart structure that keeps us in an emotional alignment with the speaker rather than you know, any of the other positions where we might enter.
But
Oh, I
then
like
that takes
that.
back to the first line of the poem, too, which is
Yeah.
about that manatee, right? The animal does not appear to be seriously injured, right? And so
Right.
really, how do we know or about the animal? And then that becomes a sort of metaphor, like both trigger and metaphor, right? For the second half of the poem, which is this sort of like confession, unspoken confession. And I'm going to mute myself because my cat is singing.
Yay.
We
We
can
have to
hear
do
it.
that.
All right. If
We
she
really can't hear it.
can't hear it, okay, good.
No.
She might
Yeah.
join the conversation in a moment. So
I
bear
think
with
if
me.
I had any qualm with this poem, it would be actually in the way that the manatee is used a bit. I was
Yeah.
thinking of this essay, Why Eco Poetry by John Shoptal, that I read. And he, was giving his own definition for what is eco poetry. And one of the things he said in it was that, the eco poem has to be, about the non-human world. And it can't be kind of just using it as a metaphor. So he gives the example of John Ashbery's poem, what is called River of the Canoe Fish. And he says, like, how this one isn't an eco poem because it's actually, about men and about gay culture and stuff. The canoe fish are not a real type of fish. And
Yeah.
so I think that
Yeah.
I think it really works on the one hand, the metaphor, but when I go back to it, then it's hard for me not to see the metaphor, what is the word she uses? Too dumb and fat, to be
Yeah.
more about her so much. It's so kind of overwhelmingly in that way. It doesn't feel always like that larger thing about how maybe we treat humans is how we treat animals too. And
Yeah.
that's fine, but that's just kind of my reading of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's possible to decenter the human because we're humans. Like, I don't think you can have any kind of, I mean, no, because I'm familiar with with this argument. I don't know that particular essay, but I always kind of have this difficulty with particularly like post-human studies, where it's like, but we are people and we do look with human eyes, and like we can't show the poem to a manatee and be like, hey manatee,
What do you
what would
think?
you please write an essay in response? And so I don't know, but I don't know if that's like a fair response, but I
Yeah, no, I think it is a fair response. I think that part of how I was thinking about it too was I recently read the most recent Pushcart anthology, and there were a couple of poems or and prose pieces that kind of started, or you entered the piece by like the narrator was on the computer. And then that's like an entryway into like a different topic. And so I feel like this poem does a really good job of having kind of that structure and it being really meaningful. And at the same time, it does make me think about kind of this message under the message of this poem that, you know, these images we're seeing of so much information, the information density of things always just ends up coming back to the self and the self's concerns anyway, even when they are, or especially when they are traumatic.
Well said, Samantha.
And I love the things that this poem is throwing up for discussion. It's pithy. You know, it's
But I
interesting
think.
because I missed this story. So this poem was my introduction to it, and I had to go and find out about, so what happened with this creature. And it's interesting that I didn't spend a long time on it, but the only article that I turned up at the time was from the New York Times. And it was very interesting to me to note that the article focused in its entirety on the response to the manatee and the concerns about how the manatee had been treated. And it didn't get into, well, why would someone do this anyway? And why is this creature being treated as a political billboard? And I just thought it was so interesting that that did not come into it at all.
And you said that the name that Trump was carved into or
Yes.
like scraped into the
Into
side
the
of
film
the.
of algae on the manatee.
I'm making a slightly horrified face, Slushies.
I think we all are. It's just bizarre.
I don't remember even hearing about that. My
Okay, so I'm
God.
not the only one. Okay.
No, this was not on my radar.
Okay. But it's a really interesting jumping off point for for this poem.
And I love the way Samantha had described that too. It's like the information density, like the ways in which we're all saturated in so many different narratives all the time, 24/7, right? And how one story lands and sends the speaker into another, like an understanding of another story. So in that way, that manatee story is metaphor, right? But it's also trigger or invitation, or it's not correlation necessarily as much as it is opportunity, right? To, you know, make sense of her, like the speaker situation. But then that's a classic metaphor, right? Like these two dissimilar things, you bring them together and you can't unsee the way that they're connected, right? And it doesn't diminish the manatee and it doesn't diminish her experience. It sort of amplifies both sides. And for me, that's like a surprising achievement of the poem, because I was ready to be like, oh, right, like we're going to use this horrific story about an animal to, you know, reflect on a horrific personal narrative. And that's exactly what it does. And it does so beautifully. And it made me calm down, you know, about like the use of metaphor, like, because this really resonates.
Well, and it's also, I mean, I think that this kind of gets at like a larger cultural trend by which humor has become both weaponized and suspicious. And so like for those of us who are deeply invested in humor, some of us have even edited anthologies with humor in the title. I wonder who that might be. You know, it gets at something sort of deeper in the culture about these suspicions and the ways in which hiding behind something that's deeply valued sort of triggers all of these spirals of thought towards a kind of final moment of terror. Do the editors of the humor anthology want to say
anything? No, but it's the thought spiral, right? Like the poem is it does that. It's sort of like, it does this sort of gyre, like, and Slushies, you can't see me making this sort of like blender gesture with my hand right now, right? But it's sort of like, it does have this gravitational center in it. The metaphor sort of spirals up into this broader consideration of terror, as Jason suggests. But I don't, Jason, I don't know what's funny about it. And this was, Kathy and I were like, you know, working on the humor anthology together. And this was our role, right? Like her big-hearted sense of humor and me going, explain the joke.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't, where is the humor? Where do you see humor or comedy or the comic at play? Other than is it in the carving of the?
Well, it's more that I see the weaponization of it. Obviously it was just a joke. Calm down, liberals. Things got out of hand. I thought, I was just playing. Yeah. You're sort of supposed to laugh it off. And so dark humor and gallows humor being a coping mechanism and something that kind of lets you get through, humor has become a way of excusing bad behavior. And so the poem's kind of relationship to humor is suspicious.
Yes.
That the jokes are at, right? The sea cow is probably too dumb and fat to feel it. It's like, what? Is that even like, it's like an Andrew Dice Clay joke. You're like, what? Is that a joke? Why are people laughing?
Like, well, right.
I don't understand.
That's the whole essence of humor. Some people actually did find that funny, right?
Right. Yeah, and that, Kathy, it's like, it's the double whammy, right? Like, obviously it was just a joke. Calm down, liberals, right? Like, as Jason says, like, weaponizes that, right? And so it becomes a sort of political metaphor first, right? And then flipping it back into the personal, right? And then that's where the terror lies, right? Like, yeah, interesting, interesting.
That how the title also kind of does its own gyrations around the poem. Like, are we kind of still good as a culture in a way that we're acting like this, right? Back and forth between the personal and the larger culture.
Oh yeah, great point. Because using that as the title is really powerful, yeah.
I'm curious to hear what you all think about the line. I wrote that as the first line of this poem and buried it anyways. Did you expect that?
I have been reading a number of poems that make that pivot in the middle, or like some gesture towards the first draft of this essay said blah, 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 or the first draft of this poem said yet yammer, yammer. So that sort of like meta textual self-reflexive gesture it feels like it's a sort of like popular trend at the moment, but also reassuring, right? Like I'm always reassured in that moment when the poem sort of speaks of itself as a poem, right? Mm-hmm. Or the speaker.
Well, why reassured? Can you say more about being reassured by it? I'm working on something similar in fiction with the ways in which film has become very conscious of narratology, and in the same way that poetry and essay have become very conscious of process. And so, can you say more about that's such a fascinating response to be reassured by it.
So Bob Stamm is the guy you'll want to read, right? On sort of film and reflexivity, precisely because that sort of narrative gesture of film's consciousness of itself as film, right? Creates a space for the audience to identify twice with the film, not just the narrative, right? The plot that's unfolding and the sort of universe they're asked to believe in, but then this sort of like meta level reassurance that the film is making an argument about the validity of film, right? Or the film is making an argument in defense of the genre, right? And the list goes on, whether it's like The Truman Show or Singing in the Rain, which I just showed to my Emirati, my students here in Abu Dhabi today. And so some of my Emirati students had never seen it before, and it was wonderful to show thing, right? So when I say reassurance, that's a personal feeling for myself, right? Like it's sort of like the Wizard of Oz, like there's someone behind the curtain who's in charge of the spectacle in a way, and is conscious of not only my experience of the spectacle, but the machinery of the spectacle as something worth defending, right? So that it's that level, that reflexive meta-textual level that feels good.
So it goes back to your work on wrestling. It makes us smart. It's
100% about professional wrestling.
Yeah. No, because I talk about this all the time, like your concept of the smart, the smart mark, that like when we're, that this makes us both the savvy consumer and the consumer.
Exactly. And gives you permission to be both, right? Like says you're smart enough to know that this is constructed, right? And I'm going to show you how it's constructed so you're an insider, right? And so like I've been like that gesture in essays too, like in the first draft this, or, you know, like that gesture just sort of brings the reader inside to the process of writing the draft, which to me is exactly what a smart mark is craving, right? So like a smart fan is someone who knows that professional wrestling is choreographed athletics, right? A mark is someone who may or may not, right? But smart fans love to mark out, right? They love to pretend, or not pretend, they like to sort of believe in the reality of the spectacle so that they can give themselves over to it. And so a smart mark is someone who's doing both of those things at once. You know that it's constructed, you know that it's a spectacle, and you get lost in the experience of it as well, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which arguably this poem is sort of playing with that, like that sense of being in the sort of information dense, information rich media landscape, right, that Samantha was talking about, right? And then having this reverie get triggered, right? Like the orchestration of the two together, that stitching is sort of like using one story to make sense of the other story and offer a sense of narrative rhetorical security, maybe, I don't know. Maybe that's, I think that's pushing it. I think it's more of a trigger here than anything.
I was going to say too that I don't know if like the AI poet bots are doing that yet. Like, so in some ways that makes me feel like there's a human there very much when I get these pinpricks of, you know, process or narratology in something that I'm reading. Say it's reassuringly human.
Yeah. and I think that might be the title.
Reassuringly human.
Tricks of process. Or reassuringly human, right? Kathy, what were you going to say?
You were clamoring about the manatees, and now you're like reassuringly human.
I just wanted to say something far stupider than anything that's been said the entire podcast.
Oh, bring it on.
When Sam brought up that line the first time when Dagny first read it, I love that she opted the line break as it is, buried it, period, anyways. And I love that she picked anyways instead of anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
There's something so, you know, conversational
and
intimate.
And like I'm finding my footing here again with this anyway. Yeah. Mm-hmm, that's Kathy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of talk for one poem.
I know. Might be a record. Manatees.
Might be a record.
We should.
We'll have to ask our stands if anybody's keeping track of the longest we've ever spoken about one poem. Kristen Hill, thank you so much. I think we are ready to vote, though. Do you guys agree?
Sounds good.
All right, let's do it. One, two, three, and it is unanimously accepted. Thank you so much, Kristen Hill. All right. I think we're gonna figuratively pass the mic to Dagny for our little teaser. Can you tell us what we're going to hear?
Thank you, Kathy. Yes, it's been a full year since we discussed a story here. We tend to discuss poetry more, but every now and then a story comes along where it's like, oh, yeah, we got to talk about that. So we are in our next episode going to be looking at Watchers by Marie Manila together. I'm really looking forward to this. So I've just found a portion of the story from near its beginning that I thought would be a great teaser for this. So this is Watchers. Mom can't stand at the neighbor's wall. She could reach across and touch, but Zany craves fresh air, as fresh as Pittsburgh air can be. Plus, she likes counting the yellow bricks Andy Warhol surely counted when this was his childhood home. The dining room, his makeshift sick room, when he suffered St. Vitus's dance. Zany is certain his bed would have been right here by the window, where he could see a hint of sky if he cricked his neck just right. She lies in his echo and imagines the day she'll appear at his factory door in New York City and say, "I used to live in your house." Andy will enfold her in his translucent arms before ushering her inside, not to act in his films or screen print his designs, but to be his equal, partner even. Zany just has to determine her own art form. It sure won't be cutting fruit cans into flowers like Warhol's mother did for chump change.
Nice. Wow. That's so rich with descriptive imagery. I felt like you were reading a poem, Dagny. My goodness, yeah. I saw everything. Yeah.
I gotta say, I mean, I think for me, the novels and stories that draw me in tend to, I feel like the authors write like poets, you know, mm-hmm. where they really just bring the story to life through language as much as anything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. is going to be a fun one.
Exciting. And
it's a Pittsburgh
set in Pittsburgh story. Park.
I was just going to say, Kath, isn't it set in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, it seems so, right? Or at least partially Pittsburgh's referenced. You know, the steel mills were already starting to shut down when I was a kid, but my mom talks about coming home with silver sparkles all over her face, like coming home from school and having sparkles on her face from the steel mills. Can you imagine there being that much stuff in the air that it was on them?
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
That sounds very dangerous. That sounds
also
really
like
scary.
That sounds like a poem.
Yeah, sparkles in her face. You know, but come to think of it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my whole family, it came from generations of mill workers. There was even an article in the paper when my grandfather retired because so many people had been employed, you know, by U.S. Steel until it tanked.
I wonder, you know, there's that, maybe it's tinsel that is outlawed now, that was used at Christmas for the tree, and it kind of is painful when you touch it. I wonder if that's what it felt like on your face.
Oh yeah, Sam, I see that.
Mm-hmm. Right, like foam, like what's that, insulation? It always looks like candy and fiberglass, and then you touch it and you're like, what the fuck is that?
Ow Yeah, and then like ow, yeah, it takes like weeks for it to really be gone.
Yeah Which is, you know, hard when you're a child. But yeah, I can't wait to read that story.
Yeah. Dagny. So Dagny, will we be reading the whole thing? Is it a short piece?
No, it's longer. So I think we'll do what we did with Paul on Earth last year, where one of us can read a short extract. I mean, last year, I think we kicked off with like the first page and a half, and then I separately did a recording of the whole story.
Right.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah,
works
really
all
well
right.
with
great.
Fiction. Yeah.
Great. All right. Exciting. So stay tuned, slushies. It'll appear in your feed quicker than you'll know. Okay, does anybody have anything else they need to talk about or would like to talk about?
Just my undying love for all of you.
Undying love. Thank you, sweetheart.
Yes, let's get into it.
Well, you know what? I'm going to take a second. So I was lucky enough to be the only one of this crew that went to AWP this year. Mm-hmm. And the slush pile gets a lot of love. Yeah. You know, the slushies are loving us back. The authors are loving us back. So many people came up and said, I love your podcast. Oh, let me have a sticker. Like already, I felt like it was actually equal, if not more, folks that I did not have to explain it to. That they were talking about, you know, they came up talking about it.
They were just in the know. That's great.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that was a nice marker. We're getting close to our, we really should know, Mayor. Is it the 6th or 7th year anniversary? March 27th is our anniversary. But yeah, so yeah, so that was nice. So there's love back, Mayor, from all of us and our people.
Nice. All right, yeah. Slushy. The love is mutual.
Okay, love. All right. Well, keep reading. Let us know how we're doing. And we'll see you soon. Bye.